Kayfabe with Jeff Bowden. That's right. I said Jeff Bowden. I did not mention the name of my co-host, Mr. Barry Rose. I did not mention that name because, you know, here we are on episode 102, and Barry recently has gotten a microphone. Oh, yeah. He finally got the microphone. I've had a fucking microphone for over 95 fucking episodes. I want some love, Barry. I want to be appreciated. Barry, how you doing?
You know, and Jeff, we're not really, we're going to stick with the story, and we're not going to tell people the real truth that that Barry has actually moved to Ethiopia where he can eat and shit 24 hours a day. So I'm filling in. I'm his cousin, Larry. And
Larry Rose.
So I'm taking over for a little bit. But it's amazing. The topic continues to be the new audio. And some people like it. I'm getting messages. Some people like it. Other people, they're not liking it quite as much, Jeff. They prefer
like
me on the, they do. They want to hear it fuzzy, little staticky over the phone. So what I want to do is.
They want you to be like the UHF channel of podcasts. Channel 51.
Absolutely. Channel 51. I want to put this out there that if anybody is truly bothered by my audio, you know, get the fuck over it. But secondly, I'll call you. If it makes you feel better, I'll call you. You can hear me over the phone and we can do it that way. I got to admit, Jeff, this is, as with everything in my life, when I'm resistant to change and then I do it, I always say the immortal words of, why the fuck didn't I do this earlier? Because this is so much easier than having to hold a goddamn phone for 2 hours.
Well, so here's what I'm thinking. If the people like you better as the UHF version of Barry Rose, so, and this is something only people, longtime people from South Florida will get this reference. Barry, does that mean you're more of a Dave Dixon or a Big Wilson?
Oh, and Jeff, I think we did this a couple of years ago. Dave Dixon, well, I am much more of a Dave Dixon fan, the late Dave Dixon fan. And I think some of our Detroit listeners that might be a little bit older would know Dave. That's where he started. But I think Dave Dixon, now that you bring him up, and we should, if you don't know who Dave Dixon was, he has since passed on. He was a slightly acerbic he was at times a very acerbic late night television host on a UHF channel in the Broward County area, going back to the late 70s, mid to late 70s, maybe early 80s. But he was great. And I would actually, I think he actually was responsible for the formation of things like my love of The Twilight Zone and Dobie Gillis, because he would literally for 4, 5, 6 hours every night, going until 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, would play all these older television shows. And I sat there and I was just mesmerized. Big Wilson was a little bit different. Big Wilson was a former like nightclub act or something, but also a TV guy. But he was this big, jolly guy with a beard, white hair, and he would play the piano when he would play older movies. And I didn't quite get into him as much, but Dave Dixon, my God, what a throwback to our youth, Jeff.
All righty. And on this show, we're not going to just discuss Big Wilson and Dave Dixon. We discuss things like, pop culture, wrestling, television, music. And today, Barry, we're going to invite the folks to go down the road of matches from the 90s again. And we are happily returning to a movie of the week. No top five this week. We are going to have a discussion of a movie that is, oh my God, so near and dear to both Barry and mine's life and hearts, because I had a chance to rewatch it. Barry, did you rewatch the film, I'm hoping?
So in the last 3 weeks, I probably have seen the movie 4 times.
Okay,
yes.
So I'm going to tell you folks that after discussing it, we completely pulled the movie out of the air last week. After the show was over, I reached out to Barry. I said, Barry, we have to do a movie of the week, and we have to discuss the brilliant Coen Brothers 1987 film Raising Arizona. And, you know, geez, I'm trying to think, was Nicolas Cage ever better than he was in this movie? Because he's fantastic in this movie.
Yeah, Nicolas Cage to me is one of those polarizing individuals where some people used to love Nicolas Cage. I can tell you 3 movies that I truly like Nicolas Cage. This obviously being one. I think the other one's pretty obvious too, Jeff, which would be Valley Girl, because We have we've certainly praised Valley Girl numerous times. And then Peggy Sue Got Married. I've always enjoyed that movie. I've always found Nicolas Cage kind of like, I don't really get it. I don't really understand it. Great in this movie. Really good in Valley Girl. But everything else, whatever.
Yeah. But so we're going to have a discussion that we all also, since I mentioned going into matches of the 90s, once again, our old friend Aaron Grafton, we're going with one of his choices. As I said, we had a select group, an elite group, if you will, of people that have joined us at the CWF Legends Fan Fest. Quick plug, Barry, go.
Yes, sir. So coming up on November the 9th, CWF Legends Fan Fest 6. And you know, Jeff, when you stop and think about it, I remember when you and I were having a conversation, actually, oddly, you brought up the story about the Wild Samoan Bull Ramos a few weeks back and the dinner's ending. My fan fest that I'm a partner of, we're actually starting at the same time your participation in those dinners were ending. And I remember having the conversation. I remember exactly where I was when we were talking about it, but it's hard to believe that we have already had five of these fan fests in a little over 2 years. And the sixth one coming up, and I'm very excited about it. And I could even break kayfabe and maybe even make an announcement here.
What?
This will be a breaking announcement, and much like my audio, some people will go, oh, I don't know if I love that. But as it turns out, because there is a big wrestling event the night before the fan fest, and that wrestling event is being put on specifically for us. That was the whole idea behind it. We are not going to be able to do Portillo's for dinner. Exactly. Now, there'll be some people that go, fuck, I, you know, Bruce Cohen right now is clutching his heart with, you know, that's loaded up with bacon grease and going, oh, my God, that chocolate cake milkshake. But the good news is, Jeff, we are going to the maybe second most requested spot, which is Culver's. And we're going to do a big get together at Culver's. And I know that personally, I have been trying to get to a Culver's because I've eaten some stuff there. I was only there once. It was primarily for ice cream. We did get the cheese curds, which are fantastic. But there is a Culver's within 2 miles of the facility that we're going to be seeing wrestling. The really good news about this whole situation is this card, which is being put on for us. This was designed for the fan fest in mind, that anybody who is part of the fan fest that is attending the next day is going to be part of a special meet and greet and photo opportunity, private only to the fan fest attendees. So, you know, anybody listening to this that is coming, and I know a bunch of people have already purchased their tickets, they are going to be part of this whole deal where you get to go in the back, get to meet the wrestlers, take photos, you know, whatever it is. So it's kind of exciting. It was something that the promoter, Ron Neamey, approached me about, and I said, absolutely. So I'm very excited about that. But taking place November the 9th at the Marriott Residence Inn, North Point Village off the Stone Cold Parkway or whatever the fuck it's called.
Suncoast Parkway there, Bear.
Suncoast Parkway.
Even if I've got it memorized.
You did. It's a stunning parkway. Chris Spiker's got it memorized. I know that. But it is, it's taking place, and we are doing number 6, headlined by arguably the greatest wrestler in the U.S. in the 1980s, certainly top 5, Barry Windham, old BW, is going to be headlining, doing a Q&A with J.J. Dillon. Very excited about that. Catered dinner. Also, story time with Dutch Mantel. We get to Dutch has a national touring show, and Dutch is going to be, and he's going to be doing our after party, which is what we call it. Usually takes place somewhere between 8-9 o'clock at night. Rocky Johnson kicks off the day with coffee time with Rocky Johnson. Rocky has his new autobiography coming out. There's a comic book coming out. There's talk of a movie. So there's a lot happening, but he's going to spend about 90 minutes just going through his life and his career. And he's very honest and very open.
I only hope, Barry, that if Rocky's stories can be turned into a movie, that he has connections with somebody in Hollywood. That's all I'm going to say. I just hope so.
Yeah, he might. There might be somebody that he may know that does have some pull, some rank in Hollywood. And I'm sure it's exactly the first person he's calling. Joining those select talents of Dutch Mantel, Rocky Johnson, Barry Windham, old BW, a personal favorite of both of ours, Jeff, and J.J. Dillon. Larry Hamilton, a guy, a great amateur credentials, but also did, you know, had a great little run in CWF in 1984, and also had a pretty sweet run in the Gulf Coast. I think it was Southeastern, where he was a major player there. Kendall Windham will be there. And then Tony Garea, a guy that actually spent time in Florida in 1972. Tony Garea is going to be joining us. So I'm real excited. It's a real kind of it's an amalgamation. It's a hodgepodge of talent. It's not guys that you normally see together. And we always try to do something a little different. And Jeff, I know you're going to be there. You told me you're flying down. Jamie Ward coming in from the Philadelphia area as well, making his first appearance. Tom Hale making his second appearance. Mark Boudry making his second appearance. Michael Herrick coming in, making his. Travis Reigns, I believe, his third appearance. And the aforementioned Aaron Grafton, 2 weeks in a row, 2 weeks with the matches. And they're both fantastic matches, and both Steve Austin matches. Aaron Grafton also coming from the city of Chicago. So very excited about this, and some other people I'm sure I'm forgetting that I hope I'm not pissing off, but I'm very excited about this, Jeff. And Jeff, I have to ask this too, because somebody did reach out to me and said, hey, is Jeff going to be selling his books at the Fan Fest? And I said, absolutely, Jeff will be there. He will not only be selling both books that he has. They call me Booker in Breaking Kayfabe, which, you know, very interesting name right there.
Yeah, but where did Jeff, I come up with that one? I don't know.
I don't know. Where did that come from? But you're also going to be signing both of these books and possibly even putting witty comments in both of these books. Is that correct?
I am nothing if not pithy. So two things related to the Fan Fest before we move on with the big match and some discussions. The night before, Barry, that you mentioned, which would – what would be that be? The 7th of November? Am I correct?
No, that would be the 8th, but the 8th. Yeah.
No, what's the night of the convention?
The 9th.
Okay, so the 8th.
Isn't it the 9th? Am I like
– whatever it is. We get confused by numbers. So the night before, exactly. The Friday night, in lieu of going Portillo's, okay, when we go to the matches, it will be, if I'm not mistaken, the Dirty Blondes versus the Heartbreak Express and the big main event, correct?
Jeff, you are 100% correct as usual.
As always.
As always. This is going to be, first off, the Dirty Blondes. To tell you that these guys are friends of the Fan Fest would be an understatement. They actually listened to our show. You and I don't know if it was, I don't think it was the last one. The one before, you and I sat there and talked with Brian Brock, about our podcast, and we were both like, wow, you listen. We were kind of like really surprised, but this is arguably maybe one of the hottest tag teams on the indie circuit. I would certainly say top five. These guys are great. They're old school. This is, you watch them and you go, these guys would have been huge stars in the territory days, super old school. And they're facing the Heartbreak Express. Another guy is Sean Pascal, who is one half of the Heartbreak Express. I believe he's been to four of our Fan Fests. He comes to every dinner at Portillo's with his beautiful wife, Jessica. So these are friends of ours. These aren't just guys that are going to get in the ring. And Sean's partner, Scott, was actually at the last Fan Fest as well. So I'm super excited. But there is going to be some other talent. Bruce Santee is going to be there. Eric Stevens will be there. And the Southern Posse. And Jeff, I have raved about these guys. These were guys that worked independents in Florida probably 20, 25 years ago. They got a small break in WCW, mostly used to put other guys over. But these guys, the Southern Posse, badasses, legit badasses. So they're going to be on the card. So I'm actually really excited because these are friends of ours, first off, and they're going to be wrestling. And rumor has it, Jeff, they're looking to antagonize the crowd.
What?
So you know what? They're coming to the right folk, because we certainly want to go ahead and play along with this as well. So I'm real excited about this card. It's going to be, you know, one of the better weekends. And I am trying to squeeze in a quick Portillo's trip if we can make it happen. I don't know exactly when we can do it. It might be an early lunch on Sunday so we can get our Italian beef and chocolate cake milkshake fix. But I'm real excited. And Culver's, as we just talked about, you know, you're a fan of Culver's. I'm a fan of Culver's. And when I saw there was one 1.6 miles away, I'm like, Culver's it is. So super excited about this weekend.
I'm just going to say, as a reminder, I think I mentioned to you before, the last visit I had to Culver's, I had a Ethiopian-like experience soon afterwards. That's all I'm going to say. So... But of course, you know, I can always get like a ice cream cone or something like that.
Jeff, I have reached out to the management staff here and I have demanded, I want the place scrubbed down. I want the health department in there the day before to make sure that we are in spick and span cleanliness.
I don't think you need to call them any kind of vile language there, Barry.
Well, but I have offered when I spoke to management, I have offered to get back in the kitchen and personally cook the food.
You certainly have indicated that you have experience in the restaurant industry, so that would be comforting. So we really should move along. Let's talk about our YouTube page, Barry, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Sweet Lou Kippelman has been adding the material on an almost daily basis. As we record this, the last one he's put up is Tito Santana. I'm sure by the time this show comes up, Lou's going to have some additional material up. I want to encourage each and every one of you to go give it a listen. And even if you sit there and you're saying to yourself, fuck you, Bowdrin, I don't want to go fucking listen. You know what I'm going to ask you to do? At least go subscribe, you son of a bitch. Even if you don't want to listen. You, I'm talking to you, the guy in the car right now. No. Don't be looking to your left or right. I'm talking to you. Subscribe to the fucking channel. Okay, I'm done. So...
Well, but Jeff, why don't we go through the laborious process of what it takes to actually subscribe to the YouTube channel? It's clicking on the button that says subscribe, and that's basically it. I mean, it requires nothing. We have got over 1,400 members in the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook group. And to that end, if you're not a member of the group and you're listening to the show, and I will tell you, our numbers on a weekly basis are higher than the members of our Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook group. What are you waiting for? It's a fun group. It's an extension of the show. You're going to love it. So please go and subscribe, because if you subscribe, it means we can continue to get guests like Stan Hansen, Tully Blanchard, Dan Spivey, Butch Reed, Ron Fuller, etc. We have had probably 20, 30 interviews, and I've loved them all, Jeff. I don't know. What's your favorite? Do you have a personal favorite?
Oh, let me see here. Well, it's always fun talking to Bob Roop, a real historian. I'm trying to think of the one-off interviews. I enjoyed I felt like Tully Blanchard opened up to us more than he did at the dreaded dinners that we've spoken about. So he was much more open with us here on the podcast. And so I really enjoyed that. Let me just say, Barry, if I can digress here for a second, because people love when I say the words I digress. So the other night, as we're wrapping up things here, as we're recording here in Casa Bowdrin in the lovely community of Coral Springs, Florida, we are moving in 48 hours, Barry, and wrapping things up. And we had a chance this past weekend to go. I want to thank my good friends Jeff and Craig Halleck for being the host of an event at Brewfish Bar and Grill in Pompano Beach, where many friends came to say goodbye to Kim and I. As someone, I think it was Travis Rains, pointed out, my retirement tour is being extended like a Terry Funk retirement tour. But I want to give a quick shout out to a couple people. First of all, Howard Baum, Bob McKeon, Richard Alfonso, and the aforementioned Craig Halleck for all being there to help us say goodbye. I'm talking about people from the Brothership group, and I really appreciate those guys being there. We had a great time, great event. And, you know, it's kind of starting to get real. My wife today, as the day of the recording, this is her last day with Select Physical Therapy. And she's been there 21 years, and it's on to new adventures up in Georgia, Barry. And we're really looking forward. Kids are flying in tomorrow to help us facilitate the move.
Yeah, you have a great support system too, that your kids would also do that. And I didn't mention Craig Halleck. Craig will also be at CWF Legends Fan Fest 6. But this is it, Jeff. You know, it's a when you and I were younger, I did a lot of moving. I was back and forth between Florida and New York and back to New York and back down to Orlando and up to PA. I moved all the time. And, you know, as you get older.
Well, there was that trouble with the law. That's why you were moving so much.
Well, allegedly. Trouble with the law. Accused. Right. Right. Okay. I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it at that. But moving is a fucking pain in the ass of epic proportions, especially as you get older, where you don't have the stamina and the strength that you once had in your youth. I would move and I would lug shit up and down 7 flights of stairs. If I even think about that, I have to go take a nap at this stage. So I certainly commend you, but it's amazing. Your family's coming down, your children, they are going to help you in this move and facilitate this move with you. And it's fantastic. So when are you in the new house? Is it like the next 3 days?
When this episode drops on Tuesday, if all things go well, by Sunday, the previous Sunday evening, we should have been in the house. We have some furniture is already there. The new TV is there. So we're all hooked up
TV
with that.
TV and bed, Jeff. TV and bed. You've got it?
No, we don't have the bed. The bed will not be there. The wife has already talked about going out and getting a new mattress. So so we may be doing that. So before we get to the match, because we got to get to the match, I do want to mention a couple things real quick that came out on Facebook and people that are near and dear to us here on the Brothership. First of all, our friend Jeff Sharkey up in Wisconsin, who I know from the CAC, recently had a medical issue. And brother, we want you to know that we're thinking about you and we wish you all the best. Jeff's just a great guy, Barry.
Oh, he's I think you texted me that and you said, I don't know if you've seen this. And then I popped on his page and I was devastated. And Jeff is he's one of the sweeter human beings out there. He's just a great guy. Highly intelligent, a true historian of professional wrestling, and he's kind of a cheerleader. It's if you've got something going on, he's the first guy in line to support you, whatever it is. So to his credit, you know, facing the amputation of his lower leg, and he's a young guy. I mean, you know, I don't even think he's even 50 years old at this stage. He's dealing with this as he appears to deal with everything with this great positive attitude and great outlook on things. So, Jeff, if you are listening and certainly you've got much bigger issues at this moment, just know that we are all in your corner. We are all fully supporting you.
So, and the other person that I wanted to, I don't know that this person has ever listened to our show, but he is a name that through the late 80s into the early 90s was extremely well known in the pro wrestling world with pro wrestling this week. And that's Joe Pedicino. And Joe Pedicino's wife, Bonnie Blackstone, posted a video of Joe's recovery from a stroke. I didn't even know he had a stroke, but when she played the video and what she did was she did it as a music video that showed Joe, I mean, like 2 or 3 weeks after the stroke to where he is now. And oh my God, it was completely devastating to see what the stroke had done to him. But now through, they show him working. I will just point this out as they showed him working with a quote unquote physical therapist. And I made a point of showing it to my wife. My wife, the occupational therapist, said, that's not a physical therapist. That's an occupational therapist. That's what we do. So let me just give credit to the occupational therapist working with Joe. But they're doing some tremendous work. Joe making a recovery, but just a very, very emotional video that Bonnie posted. So we want to send our love out to Joe and Bonnie and hopes for a very quick and speedy recovery. That is not something that usually comes with a quick and speedy recovery, but we are thinking about Joe and Bonnie.
Yeah, so when I posted that video, I probably should have put a disclaimer on it. When I posted it in the group, I should have put a disclaimer because it's kind of heartbreaking to see it. I didn't know that he had a stroke either. I don't think it was reported anywhere. I think she was being low-key about it. And it's very sad. Joe always struck me as a real nice guy. And I remember, you know, when that show aired, which I guess was what, 86, 87, maybe somewhere right around there, people would always say, you know, Joe Pedicino, he's a big guy, but boy, Bonnie Blackstone is, she's hot. Like, she's really attractive. And, you know, you see the way she takes care of him in this video and the way that she reacts. She loves this man. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that Bonnie Blackstone loves her husband. My assumption, they've been together now 35 years, maybe even longer. And it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking. I always liked Joe. I was always one of those that I always enjoyed the show. You know, the show used to come on. I think it was on 9 o'clock on Sunday nights, Jeff, if I recall correctly, in Fort Lauderdale. And it was like, they would show one of the NWA shows. I think it was Worldwide. And then they would show the pro wrestling this week. And I would always just, you know, I was like either recording it on my VCR or just in front of my TV watching it. But always struck me as a really, really good human being. So it's heartbreaking to see it. And
yes. And, you know, one thing I can tell you that you said, I was getting a swig of water. Yes. Thank you very kindly. Gotcha. You're absolutely right. What you said about Bonnie Blackstone. She's a very beautiful woman, but you know, you watch that video and the one thing that's apparent is that she's a more beautiful person on the inside because yeah. she's doing all this and she's been with him for 30 plus years, taking care of him. You know, I just looked at that and I was like, oh my God, I can't even imagine everything that that she must be going through, you know, much less what Joe's going through. So anyway, so special shout out of thoughts and prayers and love to Joe and Bonnie for what they're going through. And for, again, as I mentioned, our friend Jeff Starkey. So now that we are at the point, we can finally discuss Aaron Grafton's recommendation for our match of the week. Barry, Bret the Hitman Hart versus Steve Austin. We are talking SummerSlam 1996. Barry, you had a chance to watch it. And what did you think?
So I loved it too. And it's, you know, again, I like the fact that we have two Steve Austin matches in a row, you know, consecutively. Last week, he was stunning Steve Austin. He is stone cold here. And so, yeah, because we're doing this via Skype, Jeff is now smiling at me. He's doing so. Jeff, I just have to block you out with my hand so I could read my notes. But. You know, I one thing I was thinking about as I was watching this match, and I love this match, first off. I love Steve Austin. In the last 20 years, there have been two wrestlers that I have bought into, and Steve Austin was one of them. And when Steve Austin flipped over from the Ringmaster to Stone Cold, and it was the whole persona, you know, he was very solid in the ring, but I absolutely loved the character that he developed. I loved giving people the finger. I just loved everything that he did. I totally bought into it. I was a total Stone Cold mark, and I couldn't get enough. I tuned in every Monday night. You know, here was a guy, when you stop and think about it, he had a broken neck. He appeared on Raw within 24 hours of the broken neck, didn't wrestle for something like 6 months. I don't know what the time frame was, but was on TV every week and was the most over wrestler in the United States at that time. And that really says that that is 100% your character.
I'm not sure that he's not still, based on the recent episode of Raw. Yeah. Yeah. That he may, you know, he may not be still the most over guy in the promotion.
It's amazing. And, you know, certainly he's definitely older now. And, you know, I don't think he's ever going to wrestle again. But, you know, as I sat there and I watched this match, and I haven't watched 1996 Stone Cold, which was really the year that he exploded. I sat there and I was like, no fucking wonder I was totally into this guy. He was absolutely engaging beyond belief, and nobody else, only two guys in the U.S. have hooked me, and Stone Cold was one of them. The other was Daniel Bryan, and Daniel Bryan, what he did, you know, 5-6 years ago before his retirement, you know, he was on pace, in my opinion, to be the next big star in wrestling. So whether, you know, it's whether he was Hogan or Stone Cold, who, The Rock, whatever it was, he was over with the crowd, like, and the audience, like, like nobody else. But I love this too. So this match to me signifies everything that the WWE was doing correctly at this stage. I mean, the video package beforehand, 5 stars. You've got interviews with both guys. They're showing you the history of the feud. They're showing you what Steve Austin had done to Brian Pillman with the cane and attacking him. And they referenced the fact that Pillman and Austin were once best friends, which I thought was great. But this was just, you know, this was 100% the right way to do something from start to finish. Really good match right here. I don't know if you noticed too, George Napolitano. The famous, maybe the
veteran scribe,
veteran scribe and photographer. And maybe a lot of people used to confuse him with Bill Apter, our old friend Bill Apter. But George Napolitano is a guy that also shot the East Coast photos in the East Coast for decades. Well, he's been relegated to the third row and shooting over people's heads. So they didn't give him ringside access. So fuck you, Vince. For shutting out a guy that really just, you know, really documented professional wrestling on the East Coast for so many years. The referee of this match, Tim White. Tim White, unheralded as a referee. Really, really good ref. Perfect timing, perfect facials. Just always seems to do the right thing at the right time. And it's a guy that I think became more famous outside the ring for taking care of Andre and some other things too. And I know now, I think he's like an ambassador in some form. I actually met Tim White 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. Daniel Bryan was while he was injured, he was appearing up here at a local comic book store. And Tim White was actually his handler that day. So great guy. You know, this match is so good on so many different levels. There's a brawl that takes place outside the ring. The barricade comes apart, looks really, really stiff. And these guys look like, I mean, they're really putting forth a lot in this. And I don't remember what the backstory was, because they referenced that Bret Hart had been gone. I don't know if he was injured. I forget what it was, but I guess
it might have been. Was this the point in time when he was? They were doing like a Lonesome Dove TV series, and I know that he had a small part in that. I mean, very well could have been. That's what he was doing. He was shooting the TV show.
Yeah, definitely could have been. They did, because they don't tell you what he was doing, but they say welcome back Bret Hart. And Bret Hart says it a couple of times, and they certainly reference it as well, that he thinks Austin is like the best wrestler in the world or something to that effect. So there is this whole kind of respect thing. But these guys are really, really, it appears that they're really stiff in certain spots. They're outside the ring, and Austin does a slingshot. Hart goes flying on the Spanish announcer's table, and Jim Ross comes forth with the great line. It seems like it always happens to the Spanish guys. It's Hugo Hurt. I mean, really.
I actually made a note about that. That was a funny line.
Yeah, which is funny because this match is 23 years old, and they still do this every fucking pay-per-view or whatever they're called now. So it's really funny to see that too. Vince's voice in this, did you notice this as well, Jeff? It appears at times like it's very strained, and I don't know if he's trying to hit certain inflections, or I don't know what he's doing, but his voice is very bizarre at times. Did you catch that?
Well, I don't know if it was that, or do you think it was like he was basically turning over the lead play-by-play duties to Jim?
I mean, by sucking so bad he was doing? What are you trying to say?
I mean, the fact that Jim Ross had been brought in, Jim Ross is now going to be the play-by-play guy for all the major shows, and Vince is, you know, but your point is probably taken.
Yeah. It was weird. He would go, and Steve Austin has got him. And he would kind of get high pitched, but then he would get raspy voiced. Really, really bizarre. Steve Austin gets Bret Hart in a Texas clover leaf. And then he does the old bow and arrow, which I don't think I have ever seen Austin do that after this match. I think he had done it before, but that was really bizarre. I like everything about this match because these guys were made to wrestle each other. You've got two guys that are a perfect fit. The only thing I didn't like was the finish. And I'll let you go into detail. I just found it was kind of a cheap finish. I guess in hindsight, I understand why they did it. It was to protect both of them in a sense, but I just didn't like the finish. I would have rather it been either a clean finish. And I remember their match they had, I think it was a last man standing match, and it was and I might be wrong on this. I'm sure that one of our 90s experts can correct me on this if I am, but they had a last man standing match and Austin never tapped out. I guess he passed out, but there was that whole image of Austin. He's bleeding and he's making this great face and he's trapped, I think, in the sharpshooter, and he just passes out. And that was the double turn. That was officially where Austin became this huge baby face and Bret Hart was now the heel. But yeah, I think that match, in my opinion, might have been a little bit better. But for whatever reason, I didn't dig the finish. And I'll let you describe the match, describe the finish, and then we can discuss the finish if you like.
Well, so last week, the match with Austin and Ricky Steamboat, I said I thought was a very good match. I didn't necessarily think it was a great match. I wasn't like poo-pooing the match. This match, as I wrote it, and I was making notations to myself at the end, I wrote 4.5 stars. This was a great match. And I really, whether it's because, we're talking about this was the spectacle of the WWE, whether that played a part in it, the fact that Steamboat and Austin match was basically the semi-main event for the Flair Hogan match. I don't know whether or not that played a part in it or not. I like the fact that Jim Ross, as he's leading up to the match, compares the match between these two guys with Evander Holyfield and Mike Tyson. I like when they do sports references like that and compare it to other sports. And he made a nice little shot at the WCW during the Hogan era by saying, these guys aren't past their prime. They're still in their prime, which I thought that was pretty funny. And one of the things I thought in looking back at it in retrospect was Jim Ross makes a comment about how ironic would it be if Steve Austin submitted Bret Hart with a sharpshooter, of course, knowing that, we were maybe a year or two away. Was it? Yeah, a little more than a year away from the whole Shawn Michaels getting the sharpshooter on Bret Hart. So we had some interesting things. And let's see. Oh, here they had some timeline problems with the various past of the individuals. I think they were right where they said Steve Austin had been a pro for 7 years, but somehow they came up with the fact here in 1996, Bret Hart has been a pro for 12 years. And I'm like, I sit there and started doing the math, and I was like, well, wait a minute. I know he was wrestling before 1984. So, yeah, someone screwed that up pretty good. And then they did a spot. I want to say it was maybe a tombstone pile driver, and Vince McMahon called it a reverse pile driver. Actually, I'm sorry. I'll change that. It was an inverted atomic drop, and he called it a reverse pile driver. It's always good when the announcer screws up the name of the hold. So Bret, the finish that Barry was talking about comes at the 24-minute and 41-second mark, where Austin has the quote million-dollar dream on Bret Hart, and Bret goes to the second rope, pushes himself back, falls into the pen, and then one of the things I thought was pretty interesting is as they're walking away from the ring, that Vince McMahon actually gets up, goes over, and shakes Bret Hart's hand. I don't know if you caught that, Barry.
Yeah.
Which, that's just something you don't really see a lot. Not just from a TV announcer, but a guy who, obviously is a promoter, even though it wasn't public knowledge yet. But I just thought that was kind of an interesting little touch to the thing. So, I thought this 4.5 star, I had no problem. Like you said, the finish was made to protect both guys. I think because I think Vince obviously had plans for both guys and didn't want to, it's such a bad thing, a bad way of putting it to burden one of them with a loss because, that's what pro wrestling is. Guys win and lose and you keep programs going even though they win and lose. And if they're a good enough, wrestler, and in this case, Steve Austin obviously was, the loss, even whether it was a kind of a, screw jobby-ish or not, he's good enough to get past that. And his character is good enough to get past that. And so I really like this match. And so, Aaron, I think this is a better match than you picked last week, which is kind of funny because I think Aaron, in his recommendations that he sent us, liked the Steamboat match a little bit better than he liked this. At least that's the impression I got.
Yeah, I liked both. I think if anything, I mean, I think I like this match better also, and I'm going to tell you why. It's this match appears to be bigger. This is what the WWF clearly had over the NWA. I talked about it last week when Steamboat came out, and it just looked like he was at an indie show, the way they had everything designed. It just didn't look right. But everything about this, from the entrance to the video package, to even the majority of the commentary, not all of it, obviously, Jim Ross is always going to add something to a match. There's something that this was clearly, in my opinion, the big stage. And what we saw last week wasn't. Plus, I think, and it was pointed out, I think Steamboat just in a matter of weeks retired after the match we saw. And I don't think that was Ricky at his best. This was a better match. So I'm happy. If you want to do Stone Cold or Stunning or Ringmaster next week, Jeff, 3 weeks in a row, I'm all up for it. I'm good.
Well, I will say that I'm a little surprised, as you were talking about the two guys that really captivated you over the last 20 years. You said Steve Austin and Daniel Bryan. Yeah, a little surprised that you weren't going to throw out the name Kevin Nash just to throw Zaha a bone. You decided not to do that.
Let me say when I say that too. So a lot of that isn't based on, look, there are better wrestlers than both, though Daniel Bryan in his prime, maybe in Ring of Honor, was maybe one of the best of all time, but certainly guys like Okada, Kenny Omega, Tanahashi, Shinsuke before he made the dreaded move and came over to this country. These were guys that were arguably maybe even better in the ring, but his characters, what Stone Cold did, it was magic. It just doesn't happen. It's just one of those things. Yeah.
The thing that's interesting is that a character that can retain that appeal for so long. I'll tell you, today I was looking on, just to kind of do an apples and orange comparison here, I was looking on John McAdams Pro Wrestling and Whatever Facebook page, and they were talking about the potential nominees for the NFL Hall of Fame. And now they're at something like 50 names, and they got to narrow it down to 25 or something like that. And I was looking at him, and so there were a couple guys that were mentioned for quarterback. And I said, I got to be honest with you. I don't see anybody on this list that I would put in the Hall of Fame as a quarterback. I said, let's remember, it's the Hall of Fame. It's not the Hall of Very Good. And there were a couple of guys on there that I thought had a few really good years. Randall Cunningham, Donovan McNabb, they had a couple of really good years. Even Boomer Esiason, I think, was also on there. But did they have the kind of, look at people like, and I know – people are polarized by NFL teams now, but people like Drew Brees or Tom Brady, guys that have years, and you could compare this with baseball too, guys that do it year after year after year. And Stone Cold Steve Austin, his character has retained that for years and years. And I'll give you a comparison, because a guy that really kind of caught my attention when I began watching New Japan a few years ago again was Naito. And the whole sort of Stone Cold character that they put out in Japan of Tetsuya Naito, the anti-establishment guy, which is really a revolutionary character in Japan. A guy that would kind of look down on the establishment. He spit on his belt. He threw his belt like he didn't care. And it was a really interesting character. And yet somehow I feel like the promotion completely dropped the ball with that guy, because they never allowed that guy to take the ball and completely run with it. They kept the character, and whether it's because they wanted to keep Okada over or Tanahashi, they never really pushed Naito as far as they possibly could have. And so does that affect the way I look at Naito now, a couple years later? Because is Naito going to be able to retain that, Los Incornables deal for another, say, 5 years? Because, obviously, as we said, Steve Austin came back to Raw on the reunion night And it wasn't Hulk Hogan or Ric Flair that got the huge pops from the crowd. They got pops, no question about it. It was Steve Austin. When Steve Austin came out, he was the guy that was the female wrestlers, but Steve Austin was the fucking man that night. And that's the people that, you know, that was the guy that people were really happy to see. And when a character can invest people for, 20 years, that's just amazing. And it really speaks not only to the promotion job that Vince did with the character, but what Steve Williams did when he took the character of Steve Austin with a recommendation from, I believe, his wife at the time, Call Yourself Stone Cold, and he's invested in it and he's retained it. And, you know, you got to respect him for that because he's done it long term.
Yeah, and Jeff, I think we're going to get a cease and desist letter that we're going to be sued for you referring to him as the man.
Ric Flair is going to reach out to me and
complain. Yeah. So somebody's lawyer is going to be reaching out and we're going to be sued for that. But Joe, you're 100% right. It's apparently, if I remember the story, I think you're right. It was his wife who might have been Jeannie Clark. Was it Jeannie Clark at the time?
I'll say that's a fair guess. Let's just put
it. I think it was Jeannie Clark. And she said, why don't you just be yourself? This is who you are.
Luke Kippelman coming forth with the absolutely with Jeannie Clark. Thank you, Luke.
Yeah, and he took it and he ran with it. And you can see it. It's funny. In hindsight, if you go back and you watch Stunning Steve Austin, you can see little bits of Stone Cold in there. You know, it's kind of amazing, but he doesn't do the over-exaggerated Stone Cold that became more popular. But I'm with you. It's again, it's we're 23 years into the character and he's still the most popular thing on Raw. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty, you know, and you can certainly say, you know, guys like The Undertaker, Mark Callis took a character and, you know, there's still calls for that guy to come back. And good Lord, is he like 55 or something now? And obviously his as we discussed with Ricky Steamboat, the way that Mark Callis's body has completely changed as, you know, time. Like I said, time's undefeated. Mark Callis's body is not the same way, does not look the same as it did, you know, 20 years ago. And he was 35. So but another guy. I mean, let's give credit where it's due. Vince has had some characters that ended up being completely horrible. Turds, you know, fart in church kind of stuff. But then he's had guys like Austin, The Undertaker, that were absolutely brilliant characters. That he came up with or that he gave guys the idea for and they ran with it. And so, you know, you got to give him credit where credit's due when it's deserved.
Yeah, you do. Absolutely, too. And, you know, I as I watch wrestling now, and the truth is from a character development standpoint, I think in this country, I guess Impact does it to some degree and ROH does it. But being that they're on so much more of a smaller scale, is there anybody in the WWE, in the WWE universe that is going to be a breakout star? Who's got that ability to connect with the crowd and connect with the audience? And I don't know if there's anybody who can do it. Johnny Gargano is a guy that, if booked correctly, I think could do it. There was a period. What was that?
That was Molly saying hello by shaking her
head. Molly.
Thank you, Molly.
Thank you, Molly. I think Johnny Gargano could have done it at one point. I don't know if he's been booked the right way where he could do it. But on the main stage, you know, I don't think there's anybody that's going to reach Stone Cold heights. I just don't see it.
Well, really, do you think that is Becky Lynch as over as she was a year ago?
Not even close.
Yeah. You know, it's just like
cooled off. Like, yeah.
Tremendous. They create these characters that are like flash fires. And instead of like thinking long term with them, it's the proverbial hot shot of an angle. You know, it's like they should have taken that character and she should still be at the level that she was a year ago. There's no reason they just blew it with that character. And I just don't understand that at all. And that's an example of really not taking advantage of what you had there in the moment.
No, it's, you know, and I think partly it's, I think the booking, her booking was terrible. There might be something politically involved with it, you know, and it's ridiculous to me. Going back to that, Jeff, eight months ago, a year ago, whatever it's been, I think she was poised to, she was the biggest star in the company, and she was poised to be their breakout star. And she just, and I think partly it was the booking, she's dramatically cooled off. But you go back to, and I don't know how much, I know you don't watch a lot, but you go back to that thing where SmackDown invaded Raw, and she showed up and she got her nose busted up and she's in the ring bleeding. I mean, this woman was a star. Like, this had star potential, and somehow they found a way to fuck it up. Like, it's almost unbelievable that they could find a way to fuck it up, and it's a real shame. Who now, though? Because I watch. I generally fall asleep. Seth Rollins is as over as he's ever going to be, and he's a solid in-ring performer, but I just don't see anybody that the people are truly behind. It isn't there.
Yeah. So anyway, now let's transition before we get to our movie of the week, as we discuss Raising Arizona from 1987 with Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter. One last thing, because Barry, I know there is nothing that you love better than talking about restaurants. Going to throw a little surprise curveball at you, Barry. Last night, Mrs. Bowder and I were dining out, and at the booth right next to us, we had, actually it was right in front of us because it was connecting with my wife's seat. We had the parent and the two kids, and one of the kids was doing the whole jumping around, screaming, kicking the back of the seat. And my wife told me, it's probably a good thing that it wasn't you that was on this side. So Barry, as a restaurateur, which by the way, I think is the first time we've used that term here on Breaking Kayfabe with Adam and Barry. Barry, how do you deal with the out of control child?
Sure. So first off, what was the restaurant?
Well, let's just say it was a franchise restaurant that I like more than you. Oh, hell, it was Hooters. Okay.
Okay. So it's not an
upscale restaurant. Okay. It's a sports
bar. Right. But it's still a casual sit down restaurant that does have a liquor license, that you're going to have table service. And quite frankly, Jeff, so without getting too detailed, it was you and your wife, Kim, going out to dinner, or just only the two of you?
Yes. Just the two of us.
And can I ask how much you spent for your dinner and drinks? What was the final check?
Oh, probably somewhere in the ballpark of $30 to $35.
All right. You put a tip on top of that, no doubt. So you're probably somewhere around $42, $43. So you spent $43. You went out to a restaurant and you have a child. How old was the child? What's the age?
I want to say the kid was about three to four years old.
Then the parents have a responsibility. If you're in McDonald's, it's one fucking thing. You're in Wendy's or that shithole Dunkin' Donuts. But if you're in a place where you're spending, and look, $43 to a lot of people, you know, a lot of people make $10 an hour. That's 4 hours of work, and fuck, you'd take the taxes out of it. And that's 5 hours of work. So if you've spent 5 hours at a job that you probably don't love, so you could get money, take your spouse, your girlfriend, whatever, out to dinner, you have an expectation that you should be able to enjoy yourself. And quite frankly, if parents can't control their kids, then it's up to restaurant management to ensure that every diner in the restaurant is satisfied. And if I went to a restaurant and there was some fucking kid losing his mind, and look, Jeff, you and I both had kids. My kids were insane. You do the right thing. You either tell the child to stop, and once the child decides they're not going to stop, you walk them outside. I cannot tell you how many times as a parent, my wife or myself would walk one of our kids outside. Because we didn't want to ruin it for everybody else. So quite frankly, the kid's not at fault. Obviously, it's a 3-year-old child. The parents are fucking assholes.
Yeah. And, you know, like as my wife is prone to say, we had one of those kids, which is, as my wife said, why she stopped at 2, because it was the second one. That's right, Kelly. It was you. And, you know, that was that kind of child. But, you know, it brought to mind, you know, is it the responsibility of the person sitting at the table that maybe is, you know, was it in this example, was it my wife and I's responsibility to give the lady the stink eye, to say, hey, lady, quit having your kid kick the back of my seat? Or is it on, of course, in a best case scenario, the parent, as you said, would sit there and say, okay, yeah, little Billy or whatever, you need to, you know, slow your roll and start acting correctly? Or at what point does it become the restaurant manager's responsibility to come over and say, hey, look, your kid needs to, you know, rein it in here. So I just thought it was.
Yeah, a lot of managers, too, are pussies about that, quite frankly, as well, because they don't want to get into a situation.
Especially nowadays. Good Lord.
Exactly. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you've got a restaurant and the restaurant has, let's say, what time were you there last night?
I was like 7-ish, 7, so maybe 7:30.
It's Wednesday night. It's 7:30. There's 200 people in that building. And you've got 200 people in the building. These are all paying guests. This guy is going to hit his numbers most likely for the night. If every guest is not satisfied, there is an expectation that from the diner, and rightly so, that expectation should be met. And if you're sitting there and you've got a kid that's kicking your seat and screaming and carrying on and throwing a tantrum, then the manager has the responsibility, you know, manage your fucking restaurant. Go over there and say, I'm so sorry, but for, you know, out of respect for the other diners that are in our restaurant, could you please calm your child? And you could phrase it nicer than I just did. There's certainly ways you could do it. So, yeah, that shit like that infuriates me. And it's 100% on the parents, though, because if the parents are ignoring it, and you see it all the time, you know, what the fuck?
All right. Enough about that.
And then now another.
All right, okay, one more. Go ahead.
No, I'm kidding. We're good.
Now let's go to our movie of the week. We haven't done a good movie of the week in a while, Barry. And last week
Can I say something? What an amazing. We're discussing parenting in a restaurant, and now we're going to discuss Raising Arizona.
King of the segments. Yeah. That's me, Barry. So last week we were talking about great movie quotes that we love personally, and we started talking about how we missed the boat by not including some of the quotes from this movie. And you said that you had a chance to watch it 3 or 4 times in the last week. And I sat down the other day and watched it. And literally, I've seen this movie probably 5 times at least before I watched it again. And there were a couple of scenes that just had me howling with laughter, Barry. And it's the Coen Brothers, 1987, Raising Arizona, Nicolas Cage. It has Holly Hunter. Great cast. It's also got Trey Wilson as Nathan Arizona Sr. We got John Goodman, William Forsythe. Francis McDormand and a Randall Tex Cobb as the Leonard Small as the biker from hell, and a very, very small cameo from one of your favorite character actors, Barry, Emmett Walsh. And he's talking about finding something in the road, you know, but and there's a whole long storyline about what he finds in the road as he's telling Nicolas Cage's story. But here's what I love about this. You know, one of the things I know, Barry, that you love about Tarantino movies is the dialogue and how they just they seemingly will make something that is very innocuous completely fascinating. And that is a sign of a really, really good writer and someone that's making a really good film if the dialogue snaps along. So as I sat there and I started trying to figure out what kind of movie is this? Is this a comedy? Is it there's some action aspects. Is this when I say fantasy, I don't mean like, you know, Lord of the Rings kind of fantasy, but there's like dream sequences that go on. Maybe the movie I would compare it to in some ways, and this is pretty holy grail stuff for you, Barry, is The Big Lebowski. Because The Big Lebowski has that same kind of like dream sequence stuff going on where this guy is narrating it. And what's really funny is, I happened to really quickly look at a review that Roger Ebert had posted from many years ago when the movie first came out. He gave it 1.5 stars. I don't know what movie Roger fucking Ebert was watching that day but one of the things he complained about is he said, oh, the movie can't decide what it wants to be. And to me, that's one of the appealing parts of the movie. That doesn't detract from it. So for those who somehow over the course of 32 years, Barry, the uninitiated, this is a story of career petty criminal H.I. McDonough and his love for a young deputy at the jail named Edwina. Her name is Ed, and they go into that whole long storyline and how they end up getting married, which is another story in itself, and how they want to have a child. And they happen to notice that local furniture baron Nathan Arizona, his wife, has had 5 children, and take it from there, Barry, because, oh, my God, what a movie-going experience this is.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, too, the Arizona family, which is really the Huffines family, they have 5 kids.
My name.
Yeah, exactly. Edwina, played by Holly Hunter, she's spectacular in this role. It's on the Chris Zaha scale. She's a billion stars. She finds out that she's barren as the desert. So they decide that since the Arizona family has five kids, they're not going to be upset if they just can, if they just take one. So they basically take one of the kids, and then it's everything that goes along with it. You know, H.I. McDonough, played by Nicolas Cage in his best role ever, as we clearly pointed out earlier, is an ex-convict. So he has friends that break out of prison that come stay with him, which is Gail and Yvel, I believe is it, which the names are just fantastic. And that's played by William Forsythe and John Goodman. John Goodman, who I think at this point is a staple in the Coen Brothers films. He's appeared in multiple Coen Brothers films. The movie works, though. It's on every level. And Roger Ebert, and I liked Roger Ebert, may he rest in peace, but what the fuck was he watching? Because this movie doesn't know what it wants to be, which is what makes it work. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah. It's got action. There's empathy to it. You know, the acting is good. But most of all, Jeff, this is maybe one of the most unique and original movies ever. Like, how can you you can't compare this to anything, because there's no other movie. There's never been another film ever like this. Yeah. So I love it, too. And you mentioned great, great character actors. Trey Wilson, who plays Nathan Arizona, was also in the movie FX, but he was in a million movies. He passed away, I believe it was a heart attack, some 20, 30 years ago. So he's been gone for a while now. Emmett Walsh, who also was in the very first Coen Brothers movie. He played a private detective.
Blood Simple.
Yes, he was. Spoiler alert, but if you have never seen Blood Simple, and I am going to spoil a scene, there is a scene where, and it's Frances McDormand, who is married to one of the Coen brothers, and she's cheating on her husband. She's married to Dan Hedaya, who was from Cheers. It was Nick from Cheers. And she's married to him, and she and her lover, I guess, kill him. And Emmett Walsh plays a private detective, and he's coming through a window, and she stabs him in the hand on the window ledge. And it's such a great scene. But also from Fletch, he plays the doctor. Hey, Doc, are you using the whole fist? So I'm such a big fan of him. But I'll tell you, a guy that to me as a character actor really, I don't want to say steals the movie, because everybody's great in this movie. The guy that plays Glenn.
Yeah, he's very funny.
Sam McMurray, who was also in Christmas Vacation. He's fucking great. His delivery is just through the roof. But
what's great is, I don't mean to interrupt you, his delivery, his lack of delivery, because he keeps trying to tell these jokes and fucking the jokes up. And so as he continues to tell the joke and fuck it up as part of the character, it becomes more and more funny, because he's like looking for reaction, but he screwed the joke up, and it's just like a running gag, and it's very funny.
It is, too. And it's, look, this is my second favorite Coen Brothers movie. There were times when Blood Simple was my second favorite, but it does go Lebowski, Raising Arizona, Blood Simple. Jeff, a couple of facts, too, as we're discussing this movie before we get into quotes and stuff. This was, in the year 1987, the 51st highest grossing film of the year, making almost $23 million. Guess what number 50 and 52 was? So this was sandwiched between 50 and 52. Number 50, Ernest Goes to Camp.
Oh, good Lord.
Wait, 52.
The great Jim Varney, of course.
The great 52 was Benji the Hunted. Narrowly beating out Benji the Hunted. So clearly saying that America 1987 was not ready for a movie that as epic as this movie was. The Coen brothers actually considered another actor for the role that went to Nicolas Cage. Kevin fucking Costner was... Yeah, and in hindsight, I don't see it, but I always say that whenever I see it. I go, no, I don't see that at all, but who knows? Maybe it could have worked. But this is a movie, too, and you and I were talking about this off-air, And we just started rattling off quotes to one another. So is this one of the most quotable movies of all time?
Yeah, there is absolutely no doubt about this because, you know, like I'm going to lay on my, and this absolutely probably should have been in my personal top five. Cause when this scene came in the movie, I just absolutely broke out laughing out loud is when, when Edwina takes Hi to the doctors to explain to him why she can't have children. And the line that Hi uses in the narration is, "Edwina's insides were a rocky place where my seed could find no purchase." And the doctor, meanwhile, on screen has this like chart that's showing a woman's vagina, and he's pointing out all the places where things aren't happening. And by the way, can I just say that Nicolas Cage's hair in this movie was a character on itself because his hair is all over the place. And, you know, they must have used so much hairspray because his hair is in all different directions. And it's funny. I don't know if just give a little quick love. Frances McDormand is on the screen for maybe 5 minutes of this movie. But her 5 minutes where she's counseling Ed about, you know, now that she has a child and all the different things, how she needs to get the shot, the Diptet.
You got to get him the Diptet booster.
The Diptet, yeah.
Or else he'll develop lockjaw and not get you.
And so she's going over all the different things. And then, of course, they find out later that the two of them, the Frances McDormand and Sam McMurray's characters, Glenn, that they're swingers. It just makes it completely horrifying. But so anyway, we reached out as we had done in the past, and we'll get back to it because I'm sure before we leave, Barry, we're going to have to do a couple more quotes from this movie because, my God, it's just absolutely brilliant. So we reached out to our old friend, Travis Raines. He came in out of the bullpen because we had someone that at the last minute got called into work, could not review the film for us. So we appreciate Travis coming in a Mariano Rivera like a save attempt here. So we're going my old friend Scott Hudson, former WCW announcer, Barry. We're getting do we want to say a celebrity review here? Because we don't want to call Travis a celebrity. He thinks he's a celebrity, but he's not. So I'm going to take the Scott Hudson review. You're going to take the beloved Travis Raines review. How about that?
That works, too. And I absolutely love that Mariano Rivera reference. Sweet Lou, maybe you can pipe in Enter the Sandman just before I start to read Travis's review. But Travis has a real nice review. It is short and sweet. Raising Arizona is one of my favorite movies of all time. Lots of great moments throughout the film that seem to get better with age. The film follows the life of Nicolas Cage's felonious H.I. McDonough and his fiance and former cop Ed, played by Holly Hunter. They come up with a plan to steal one of Nathan Arizona's quintuplets. The story that follows is a hilarious journey that includes swinging bosses, escaped convicts, diaper runs, and ruthless bounty hunter played by Tex Cobb. I don't want to go into too much detail since I believe it's a movie that needs to be seen and to keep the haters on the page quiet. I give it 10 big fucking boxes of Pampers and 27 pairs of panties for your head. And that's funny too, because they do reference Pampers and panties. And I think one of the keys of this movie too, Jeff, is every actor in this film, I don't want to say overacts, but amps it up to a slightly cartoonish level. And it works because, Holly Hunter has never acted like this. Every time Holly Hunter says something, she says it with passion, and then she'll kind of scream it and start to cry. Like when she goes, I love him so much. Just out of nowhere, she'll just start to do that. And you mentioned Frances McDormand, and she's the same. Like, I've never seen her in this type of a role. So everybody's just from A to Z is fantastic.
Yeah, and you know, we didn't even mention the scene involving going on a Huggies run, because that's like a scene that the continuity and all that goes on in this scene where they go into a 7-Eleven and they steal a bag of Huggies for young Nathan Jr. Is just hilarious on its own.
What are you building there, Jeff? You building furniture? No, what are you?
Gunny has decided that he's going to be part of the show by wagging his tail against one of the 400 boxes that we have in house. But no, the run for the Huggies is just absolutely one of the most hilarious scenes you'll ever see. And, you know, when he says he looks at his wife, goes, "You son of a bitch." And he tells the clerk, I'm going to go Dutch with the wife here because she's mad at him. So let me real quick read Scott Hudson's review, because Scott has not quite as short as Travis, but Scott has an interesting take on it and how it incorporated into Scott's current job, now that he's no longer a WCW announcer, that I found pretty interesting. So Scott writes, first hold up, Raising Arizona is 32 years old. My God, I have socks older than that. Raising Arizona is the second film in the au revoir of Joel and Ethan Coen, and according to Ethan, their last film to make any significant amount of money. The plot is simple. Two infertile rubes. That's a good line, Scott. Two infertile rubes kidnap a child from a wealthy, unpainted furniture magnate to start their own family. Hilarity ensues. Anyway, Raising Arizona holds a special place in my heart. Since 1998, I have been on the adjunct faculty of the Administrative Office of the United States Courts teaching federal criminal procedure. That's quite a mouthful there, Scott. Since that year, we have used the scene where Nicolas Cage robs the convenience store and carjacks the goofy old man in his pickup truck as a factual predicate in determining sentence enhancement factors. We use it to this day. How about that, Barry? That's pretty impressive stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, Cage's High McDonough found himself before a federal judge, or had he found himself in front of a federal judge, he and his co-conspirators would have found themselves in a high dungeon. Oh, it ain't armed robbery if the gun ain't loaded. See, U.S. versus Chrisman, 193, Federal 3rd, 1023, 8th Circuit, 1999. I like when a guy puts his case law up there. We released ourselves on our own recognizance. He gives another cite and give me that baby, you warthog from hell. So I like a guy that puts federal statutes in there to placate his responses here. Despite being rife with dubious conclusions of law, Raising Arizona remains uproariously and laugh out loud funny. The sequence that begins with H.I.'s robbery of a convenience store and ends with, well, it ain't Ozzie and Harriet, may be the most gut busting 6 minutes in film. Nicolas Cage is as well Nicolas Cagiest, and Metro Atlanta's own Holly Hunter, throwing a little love to Atlanta there, is perfect as a deadpan foil. What's really quite amazing is that among the cast are 3 Academy Award winners, 3 Emmy winners, and countless other acting prize winners. None had won anything at the time of the filming. Someone did an outstanding job casting this one. And it shows the roller coaster ride of Raising Arizona brings us back to the pavilion with, and I refuse to put spoiler alert about a film that came out when I was still dating Kristen, for God's sakes. Shout out to Kristen, apparently. A happy ending. Or maybe it was Arizona, which is one of the closing lines. Thank you, Scott, for that review. Good talking with you, buddy. So, yeah, we talked about this before we started recording, I think, Barry. Holly Hunter, her facial expressions in this movie are just so funny. The scene where the doctor is explaining her barren landscape to H.I., and she has this, like, silent scream, except it's not done in a sorrowful way. It's hilarious where she does this scene where she's like crying and there's no audible sound coming out. William Forsythe and John Goodman as the ne'er-do-well prisoners who have escaped. And we didn't even talk about that, Barry. The scene where they escape through the prison, which I can only say looks like childbirth if it was happening out of someone's ass. And that's like a wild way of putting it. But it is it's the most disturbing looking escape, because let's just say one of the two guys comes out as a breech birth, Barry.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's, you're right too. It's everything about this movie. It works. How does somebody have the vision to come up with a film like this? Because this easily could have tanked, and like Roger Ebert obviously hated it, but, it just absolutely works. That is a very strange scene too, but fuck, the movie's what, 32 years old, but when they decide to go back, it's like the reverse of that whole birth,
And you know, when Goodman comes out, he emerges from the mud, you know, it's not completely unlike the scene in Shawshank Redemption where, when he emerges from the sewer. And John Goodman comes up and he's just absolutely screaming out loud while raising his arms. And, you know, it's almost like a birth. Like, he's coming out of prison and going through the mud and all that. And he sticks his head up and then he emerges with his arms. And it's a very, I don't want to say it's Christ-like the way Shawshank Redemption was, but it's definitely an amusing take And it's very much, it looks like an, you know, like childbirth. And it's very funny. This is a movie that Barry and I cannot recommend highly enough, just for the quote factor, the quotability factors, the funny scenes. Oh my God. There's just so much greatness about Raising Arizona. And we will put a link to the IMDb page. By the way, IMDb only giving this 7.3, Barry. I thought it would have been rated a little bit higher than this, but still a movie that you should, if you get a chance, don't just wait for it. Go out, seek it out, and watch it.
Yeah, it's on cable. I don't know what channel it was on, but I know that it's on one of the premium cable channels. And when I saw that, I DVR'd it, and that's why I've watched it. And it's kind of become my go-to movie. If it's 11:30 and I'm knowing that I'll be asleep within the next few minutes, I kind of put it on and I'll watch it, and I still laugh. Yeah. You know, there's so much in there too. And I know I pulled up a couple of quotes last week, but you know, it's Glenn has got, and Glenn to me was, cause other than Christmas Vacation, I don't know where else I had seen this guy, Sam McMurray, but his delivery on everything is great. And yeah, I think we are, Jeff. I think we are going to be wrapping up. So it's, yeah, shit. I shouldn't have answered that. Sorry. All right, cut that part, Lou. I apologize.
No, you know, it's perfectly fine to because there are so many, you know, like I pointed out, I'll give you a real subtle scene that there's a scene where Nicolas Cage is reflecting on all the things that have happened to him towards the end of the movie, and they're panning over what's happened to all the characters that he's encountered in the film. And among the people that he encountered, of course, is this clerk at like the little stop and go.
Oh, he's great.
And the scene is that, and I told Barry this before we started recording, the guy is asleep at the cash register. Okay. He has a copy of a magazine across his chest. Okay. They could have easily made it a Playboy or something like that. The fact that they make it a Jugs magazine, which I believe that's the first time we've referenced Jugs magazine, or did we talk about that a couple weeks ago? But anyway, the fact that they made it Jugs magazine just cracked me up. That's the kind of just little small stuff that I love about this film. There's so much subtle stuff that they throw in there. You know, the scene where they're sitting out there in the lawn chairs, you know, and these are the good days. And to them, a trailer out in the middle of the desert sitting on lawn chairs is the best part of their days. And there's just so many subtle things to this film. Barry, let's wrap it up because I could honestly spend another hour talking about quotes from this movie. So you about ready for the go home, my friend?
I think this is time. Let's do it.
Okay. So folks, I would encourage you to follow me on Twitter, Baldrin Jeff, Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Do not wait. Do not pay the toll and pass go. Go out and find Raising Arizona by the Coen brothers. And if you do yourself a favor, go out and search out that well-recommended by our friend Aaron Grafton, Bret Hart versus Steve Austin match from SummerSlam 1996. Really worth looking at. And until next week, by the time this comes out, folks, I will be a resident of the Peach State of Georgia. So from the Peach State of Georgia, see you next week.